52. 4:05 p.m., November 15, 2018, International Museum of Surgical Science, Chicago, Illinois. Ashanik woke to find the car idling, pulled into a parking space alongside the colonnaded International Museum of Surgical Science building. Both Kojo and Matilda turned around in their seats to look at her.
How are you feeling?
Matilda asked.
I'm okay, I guess. Little headache, but...
But what? Ashanik thought for a second before she spoke.
While I'm scared, I'm losing myself. I don't think these memories are such a bad thing. Not the way my mom made them sound. I mean, it doesn't feel unnatural. For her, they were nightmares. Terrible things she didn't want to see, even when they were good. She said they clogged up her thinking, made her feel like she was going crazy. But not me. These memories, this sounds stupid. But even when they hurt, it feels like I'm being put back together, not pulled apart like my mom felt.
You know what I think? Kojo said. You should have some water.
He turned to Matilda.
There's a bottle under your seat.
Keeping the gun level as best she could, Matilda reached under the front passenger seat and pulled out a blue thermos, half filled with lukewarm water. She handed it back to Ashanik. The girl took several long gulps. She handed it back.
Keep it, Kojo said. She needs it more than me.
I'm not talking this way because I'm dehydrated, Ashanik said.
She took another drink before she looked at the museum.
I need to meet someone named Childers here. Childers will take me to Dr. Song.
And you honestly believe Dr. Song is going to fix this?
Kojo asked.
Dr. Song is the only person who knows what's going on inside my head. This is what my mother wanted, Detective. This is what she fought for.
Ashanik turned to Matilda.
Is Lucy okay?
Matilda nodded.
Yes, thank you. I called a few minutes ago. She shook up, which is to be expected. I can't believe I put her in that situation.
You didn't know, Ashanik said. How could you know? I was running on adrenaline, just going with my gut.
Going home.
Ashanik smiled.
You're something special, Matilda said, reaching back and squeezing Ashanik's knee. I hope you know that.
Matilda wanted to say more, to tell the girl how sorry she was for everything that had happened, and how determined she was to make sure Ashanik was safe when all the horrors had passed. But she wasn't sure that would happen anytime soon, if ever. Matilda prayed the girl couldn't read that worry, that clouding pessimism in her eyes. She needed Ashanik to stay strong.
Should we go in? Kojo asked.
Ashanik nodded. Kojo flashed his badge to a security guard at the museum's entrance. He told the woman they were there to talk to someone. The guard didn't ask questions and waved them through the metal detector.
I don't have to fill out anything about this, right?
The guard asked.
You're cool, Kojo said. We'll only be a little bit.
Museum closes in less than an hour.
They made their way through a few exhibits. A cabinet with old-school prosthetic limbs. An iron lung. 18th-century medicines. Before reaching the second floor. There they entered the library. Kojo walked around the room first, scanning the place in officer mode, and seeing nothing that raised his hackles before he motioned for Ashanik and Matilda.
No one's here, Ashanik said. Maybe we're early, Matilda suggested.
Kojo said, just be on guard.
The room was relatively small. It had a marble floor and ornate wooden bookshelves lining the walls. There was a single large table in the center of the room, and 12 leather chairs seated around it. As Ashanik made her way around the bookshelves, leaning in to read the titles behind the glass, Matilda and Kojo peeked into an adjacent room. It contained an exhibit and was empty as well.
So what time is Childers supposed to be here?
Kojo asked Ashanik.
By 4, she said, still looking over the books.
Kojo walked over to a window and looked out at the ground below, while Matilda sat at the table. She called Stony Brook again to follow up on Lucy, but the signal was busy. She scanned her cell for news about the shooting, but there wasn't much information available. She doubted the killer had been caught. Kojo walked over and leaned up against the table.
I'll get follow-up alerts, Kojo said, noticing her cell screen.
God, I don't even know what I'd do with myself.
Hey. No, it's not your fault, okay? You were doing good. This guy,
his name is Raid, Ashanik interrupted. He's one of us.
One of you, but he works for them? Kojo asked.
Ashanik nodded before she went back to looking at the books. Kojo pulled out a chair and sat down beside Matilda.
You did pretty amazing today, he said. Considering the chaos you've seen over the last 2 days, you seem very in control. I'm impressed.
I'm about 2 seconds from falling apart, Kojo laughed.
Nah, that's not you. I can see you're strong. Got that look in your eyes. You might not know your way around handling a firearm, and I was a little concerned in the car, but I could tell you were in this all the way.
You care about her.
And even more, you believe her. That's saying something.
You convinced?
Kojo rolled his neck as he considered.
I'm gonna be honest with you. I don't know. I know whatever is going on has a whole shitload of people upset. That guy back at the nursing home, the cop Ashanik killed.
Matilda recoiled hearing that.
In self-defense, Kojo clarified. I'm not going to judge you two on that. You say he was going to shoot you.
He was going to kill Matilda,
Ashanik said across the room.
And I'm trusting you on that. I am. All I'm saying is that this thing, it's complicated. This goes beyond just a Chicago homicide detective, a university psychologist, and an 11-year-old girl.
What are you saying? Matilda leaned forward.
I'm saying we need help. The police.
Try to kill us, Ashanik scoffed.
Kojo continued. And the FBI, Homeland Security. I don't know. But I'm telling you, we're going to need assistance to get out of this. We both want that guy, the guy called Raid, taken out. We also both want to get Ashanik some help. I get that you're following what Janice said. But what if no one shows up here? Or worse, what if Raid and 10 of his best, baldest friends walk in that door? Can we please agree that if no one walks in here named Childers in the next 15 minutes, we'll leave?
Matilda looked to Ashanik. The girl shook her head. I've got no other place to go, she said.
That's what I'm trying to fix, but...
Kojo didn't finish his thought before he jumped out of his chair, gun pulled and leveled at the young woman who just walked into the library. The young woman placed her hands in the air. She was exceedingly tall and thin, wearing leather pants and a jean jacket. Her lips and nose were pierced, and half her head was shaved. The other, a swoop of black hair that fell across her left eye. As she walked closer, Matilda saw she had green eyes.
I'm Childers. Who the fuck are you? You armed, Childers? Kojo asked.
Childers nodded.
Okay, Kojo said. Take out your piece and put it on the floor.
Childers rolled her eyes before using only her right hand. She pulled a Glock from the back of her leather pants. She placed it on the floor carefully.
There's no time for this, she said. The girl needs to see Dr. Song now.
Kojo said,
We'd all like to see Dr. Song. Nope, Childers said. Just Ashanik.
No deal, Kojo said.
You're wasting time.
How can we trust you? Matilda asked,
hand on the Colt, tucked into the back of her pants.
Childers locked eyes with Ashanik. When your mother was found in the snow, Dr. Song put a blanket around her shoulders. He gave her hot tea with honey. She'd never had honey and tea like that before.
You know how that felt, don't you? How it felt to be cared for. And when things changed, he was the only one who tried to help. Dr. Song is waiting for you, Ashanik, but you need to come alone. These people, they don't understand.
Tears bathing her eyes, Ashanik looked over at Matilda.
It's true, the girl said. I need to go alone.
Kojo shook his head. This is a big mistake.
I trust her, Ashanik said.
Kojo wouldn't let it go. Matilda, you yourself said these people are capable of anything. They got into the university, into the nursing home. How'd they find you? How'd they track you across the city? This group, the Human Ecology Division or whatever it was called, they have deep pockets and all the connections.
Childers knows things no one else knows, Ashanik said.
And she could be faking, Kojo said. Maybe there's a file on your mom. Maybe she just pulled all this information from it. How do we even know there is a Dr. Song? I'm telling you, I've been doing this thing for a long time, and I've never seen bad people with this much power. We're not handing the girl over alone.
Childers said, you're making this worse for all of us.
Please,
Ashanik begged.
I trust her.
Matilda stepped over to Kojo. She placed her hand on his arm and slowly forced him to lower his firearm.
This is wrong, he insisted. Don't let her just walk out of here.
It's okay, Matilda said. She understands.
Kojo just kept shaking his head, disbelieving.
Thank you,
Ashanik said. She walked over to Matilda and hugged her. As they embraced, Matilda slipped her cell phone into the girl's pocket. Ashanik noticed and looked up at Matilda. Matilda mouthed,
trust me.
Ashanik nodded. Ashanik crossed the room to Childers. The older girl opened her backpack and pulled out a metal detector wand. She scanned Ashanik. The wand was silent. She put the wand back as Ashanik turned to Kojo.
Thank you, she said. Take care of Matilda.
Childers picked her Glock up off the table. You did the right thing, Childers said. Kojo and Matilda followed Ashanik and Childers to a staff elevator. Childers inserted a key, and the elevator door sprang open. She stepped inside after Ashanik.
It's going to be okay, Ashanik said to Matilda. Dr. Song will fix me.
The doors closed. Ashanik was gone. 53. 4:32 p.m., November 15, 2018, International Museum of Surgical Science, Chicago, Illinois.
Give me your cell.
They were back in Kojo's car, and he was furious. Matilda asked again,
please, hurry, I need your cell.
Kojo couldn't believe he'd allowed Matilda to let Ashanik go like that, with some random punk girl. He held in his rage and handed over the prepaid smartphone, eyes glued to the outside of the museum. He assumed that if Childers and Ashanik came out the front or side, he'd see them. Even if they ducked into an alley behind the building, they'd have to walk back to the street to get anywhere.
Why do you need my cell?
Matilda said.
Watch.
Kojo turned his attention to the screen as Matilda logged into a tracking app. A window opened, displaying a map of Chicago.
I slipped my cell into her coat, Matilda said. We can follow them.
She held up the cell phone so Kojo could see two little blue circles positioned close together on the digital map. One of them was moving down East Burton Place toward Astor. He assumed that was Ashanik. The other of them was stationary. Somehow, despite his watching, Childers and Ashanik had snuck past.
Are you waiting for a green light?
Kojo cleared his throat.
Nah, I'm ready.
He fired up the car and pulled out into the late afternoon traffic. They followed the tracking signal down North Astor Street before it came to a stop near an alley. Kojo pulled the car over, and together they watched the screen for a few seconds. Ashanik's blue circle wasn't moving. It was sitting in the entrance of an alleyway.
We're about to be ditched, Kojo said.
He kicked the car into gear and back into traffic. Kojo knew the city well enough to not even bother looking at the screen. When Brandon was just a preschooler, 2 years before Constance died, Kojo had made the fours and was determined to show his first partner, Bob, a fat racist from Michigan, that he wasn't there because of affirmative action. He wanted Bob to know he was invested, if not more, in the safety and security of the city he called home. Bob couldn't divorce Kojo's dark skin or his crazy-ass name from the fact that he'd grown up in a blue-collar neighborhood and went to a decent high school. The way Bob saw it, Kojo had just swum over from Ghana and was two paychecks from joining a terrorist cell. So when Kojo's shift ended, his education began. Kojo could cite rules and regulations till he was out of breath, but none of it meant anything to Bob. Only thing he understood were the streets. For Bob, if you knew the streets, you knew the town. So Kojo spent hours getting lost, mostly in his car, sometimes on his bike or on foot, and finding his way back to where he'd started. He memorized every street around the station house within a 15-mile radius. That included every alleyway and parking lot. First time they chased down a fleeing suspect together, and Kojo navigated without assistance, Bob was impressed. He said nothing, but Kojo didn't need the words. He could see it in Bob's eyes. Bob had a heart attack 5 months later at the police gym and died face down on a treadmill. Kojo went to his funeral with Constance. When his widow told them that Bob had only great things to say about him, Kojo nodded appreciatively and said, "I'm so sorry for your loss. He was a great cop." The street Ashanik stopped on was one of those Kojo had memorized so many years ago. He hadn't been down it well over a decade, but he hadn't forgotten any of its particular quirks either. He swerved the car right up to the gutter, alongside a parking garage, and jumped out. Matilda followed. "There," Kojo said, as they entered the garage. Matilda's cell lay on the concrete, near an SUV. She picked it up. The screen was cracked, but otherwise the cell looked okay. "You think they got into a car?" she asked Kojo. "I think they're still nearby," Kojo said. "Why? You want me to say it's a cop sense, right? That'd be kind of cool. But no, it's actually the fact that Ashanik left us some clues." Kojo pointed to one of the girl's bracelets. It was the yellow one, lying on the ground beside a steel door that was slightly ajar. "Smart girl." Gun drawn, Kojo opened the steel door. The entrance was clear. He motioned for Matilda to follow him up a staircase to another door marked in faded letters, "New Beginnings, Rehabilitation." The door was locked. Kojo tried it twice. "Come on, we'll have to go around." The entrance to the building, just on the south side of the parking garage, was a series of brick steps that led to glass double doors. Both of the doors were marked with the swirling blue New Beginnings Rehabilitation logo. This was a drug treatment facility. Kojo knew the place well. His neighbor's kid had wound up here trying to get clean. Kojo and Matilda walked inside. "How can I help you?" a middle-aged receptionist asked from behind a desk lined with fake flowers. He was in his mid-60s and had pierced ears. Kojo flashed his badge. "We need to take a look around." The receptionist hit a buzzer, and the door to his right unlocked. Passing through the door, Kojo and Matilda made their way down a wide hallway lined by residence rooms. Most were the size of an average hotel room, with two beds and two dressers, a curtain on a track to separate the sides. Kojo checked the rooms on the right, while Matilda glanced into those on the left. Most were empty, the inpatient residents out at group time, or in the dining area, starting dinner or playing cards. Flyers on the wall announced that there was going to be a screening of The Wizard of Oz in the break room. Popcorn would be served. They came to the end of the hallway, where it split left and right. "You head right, I'll take left," Kojo said. "I'm not exactly trained for this. We're trusting Childers, right?" "No,"
Matilda said. We're trusting Ashanik.
54. 4:58 p.m., November 15, 2018, New Beginnings Rehabilitation Basement, Chicago, Illinois. Ashanik sat on a folding chair in a bare concrete antechamber. At one time, it might have been a furnace room, but it had clearly been remodeled to look like a bunker, the kind of place George would have hidden in during a Kraut shelling. The ceiling lights were inset. The door was burnished steel. After she'd taken Ashanik to the room, Childers told her to wait, that she'd be right back with Dr. Song. The waiting was hard. Ashanik didn't want to panic in the room, but it made her claustrophobic. It reminded her too much of the Clarity Base in the snow, in her mother's memories. The feeling of being caged, of being kept, reminded her of the videos Tomiko had shown. Those flashing images seemed to hit nerves she didn't know she had, triggering a cascade of emotions she couldn't control. Ashanik couldn't go back to that space. She had to focus to calm herself. But thinking about Tomiko only led to thinking about Raid, and that made the muscles in Ashanik's jaw clench and ache. So she took a deep breath and scrolled back through her mother's life. Her mother had used so many names, but they didn't confuse her. Janelle, even though she'd really only just remembered it, sounded much better than Janice. Janice always felt like a name she'd been given at work. It was too perfunctory, too formal, and didn't fit with who her mother had been. But Janelle, there was something organic about that name. It matched Ashanik's memories. It felt right for her skin tone and her hair. Ashanik repeated the name over and over in her head. There was magic in it, a name to fit a mantra. There was a knock on the door. Childers stepped inside. You ready? Ashanik stood up and followed Childers into the corridor outside the room. It was lined with pipes. This is what Ashanik imagined a sub-basement looked like. She'd heard of basements beneath basements, and always imagined they were choked with pipes and wires and rats. She prayed there were no rats in the corridor with her. She also prayed the lights didn't suddenly go out. George had seen rats in the trenches. There was an instance in the Battle of the Somme where he was walking through a narrow trench past the bodies of fallen regiment men who were injured but dying. George knew they were beyond medical attention. Their only hope would be a quick salvation. The dying men plucked feebly at his pants legs. They begged for water, for help. One man begged him to kick the rats away. He said they were chewing through his boots to his toes.
The rats in the trenches. So many rats.
Stumbling, Ashanik closed her eyes to push the memory away. She knew she was getting worse. Dr. Song had to help her soon. Childers stopped at a door with a biometric lock. She leaned up against it so the sensor could perform a retinal scan. The door unlocked with a heavy clank. As Ashanik passed through the doorway, she felt like a fairy tale character. The girl who wandered into Bluebeard's hidden room. She'd never heard that fairy tale before, but somehow she knew it. It was from an earlier life, a quieter life. The room wasn't dark or filled with cobwebs. It was not the sub-basement torture dungeon filled with rats. Rather, it was a clinic. Modern and relatively clean, it was a large, rectangular, and windowless room with low lighting that buzzed from a dozen or so flat-paneled lights inset in the walls. There were cameras and sensors in the corners. But it was what was hanging in the middle of the room that caught Ashanik's attention first. There were people suspended from the ceiling. Three people, in fact. Two men and one woman. All of them hung supine in mesh hammocks from the ceiling, their bodies about 3 feet off the floor, roughly at waist height. Around them, medical equipment beeped and droned. Ashanik had seen this equipment in Janelle's memories of Alaska. These were heart monitors and oxygen sensors. The people in the hammocks didn't move. They barely seemed to breathe. All of them were connected to IV drips, the clear plastic bags hanging over their heads, like jellyfish floating in the digital glow of the machines. Even though she wasn't going to take their pulses, she could sense that these people were alive, but in deep, deep comas.
"This is the legacy of Clarity."
The voice was brittle, but familiar. Ashanik turned around to see Dr. Song standing behind her. He was much, much older. The years had worn him down like rain wearing the side of a mountain. Deep wrinkles etched his face and neck. He wore a lab coat with stained sleeves and an out-of-date skinny tie. He exuded an air of age and comfort. Even the lenses of the big glasses perched on his nose were smeared.
"Welcome home," he said.
"Who are these people?"
"Those are the survivors," Dr. Song said. "They're dreaming. The man to your left is Terry. The woman is Alice. The other man is named Hugh. You know, you are the spitting image of your mother. It is amazing to see her. You again."
Ashanik ignored Dr. Song's comment. "Will these people wake up?"
"That depends," Dr. Song said.
"Depends on what?"
"On what you have inside your head."
55. There was a dragging sound as the door to the clinic opened and Childers appeared. "Sorry, Dr. Song, I tried," she said. Childers stepped aside and Kojo and Matilda stepped into the clinic behind her. Kojo had his gun drawn and Childers' Glock tucked into the front of his pants. He pointed to a corner and Childers obediently walked over to a wall and crossed her arms. Dr. Song shook his head.
"No need for this," he said. "We're all friends here."
Matilda ran to Ashanik and they embraced.
"You need to let me do this," Ashanik said. "I need to know what this is first.
I made a promise, remember?" Kojo passed Childress's Glock to Matilda before he crossed the room to a folded wheelchair in the corner. He unfolded it, then rolled it over to Dr. Song.
"Have a seat," Kojo said.
The wheelchair creaked as he sat.
"Talk,"
Kojo said.
"Who are these people you're hiding down here?" "These are some of the Null," Dr. Song explained. "Like Ashanik's mother, they were members of an experiment that began 52 years ago. Project Clarity, the Human Ecology Division, CIA mind control experiments," Kojo said. "I know what Janice Walters thought was going on, and I'm not dumb enough to ignore that good people, well-meaning people, can do terrible things. You were part of Clarity as well?"
"Yes. I was a young neurosurgeon at the time, and you're right. Our intentions were beneficent. You have to understand, when Clarity began, it was an attempt at understanding how the mind functioned to improve people's lives, but sadly it devolved into something I'm quite ashamed of."
"I'm guessing you're going to tell us that the bald cat?"
"Raid, number 19.
"That dude, yeah. You're going to tell me he's out there cleaning up whatever mess Clarity left behind, removing witnesses like Ashanik's mom. What I need to tell you is how we're going to make this girl well."
Dr. Song cleared his throat, his eyes on Ashanik.
"This particular condition she has is irreversible. The memories that are flooding in her brain are not going to stop. They will continue to enter her consciousness and overwhelm her. It has happened with every Null since the very first we created."
Hearing this, Ashanik felt a lump form in her throat. She didn't want to cry again, certainly not in front of Dr. Song. Her mother had taught her that crying was natural, normal, and to be appreciated, but that many people saw it as a weakness. Her mother told her those people, the ones who saw it as a negative, would all cry eventually, and when they did, they'd nearly burst. Ashanik didn't want to look weak in front of Dr. Song and Childers. She needed them to know she was strong. "Janice Walters seemed to be functioning pretty well," Matilda said.
"She was taking Metrotime regularly,"
Dr. Song said.
So is Raid. But it's only a stopgap measure. It all depends on the neural activity associated with the hippocampus.
Dr. Song took a moment to reconfigure his thoughts.
You are familiar with cyber attacks, correct? How hackers will bombard a website with incoming traffic from thousands, sometimes millions of interlinked computers. Basically, a denial of service attack. The same thing is happening in Ashanik's brain. All those memories going back to the very ascendance of our species, our awakening. All of the null eventually go insane. No human brain is able to process all that data. This process can take years, decades even. But Ashanik is different. She's the daughter of a null. The first that I'm aware of. And that makes her quite special. I can slow the attacks down with the medication, but eventually, even that fails. With the others at that stage, there is only one option.
Dr. Song rotated in the wheelchair to look at the people in the hammocks.
They are in medically induced comas. It is the only way.
Fuck that, Kojo said. You're not putting her under.
No, of course not. I want to fix her. Clarity was a tragedy. Our whole network, the former guards and nurses finding and saving the null, the former subjects who gave their lives to get Ashanik here, they all want the same thing. Forgiveness. They found me first.
Dr. Song pointed back to one of the comatose men.
13. His name's Terry. He and number 26, Alice over there, found me a decade ago. Came to my lab. I don't know how they tracked me down. They'd been taking all sorts of drugs, sharing them with the other null. They had this whole revenge thing going. They were sending mail bombs to former Project Clarity researchers and staff. I refocused their energies on prolonging their lives and turned them on to Metrochime. But for a lot of them, the damage had already been done. Theo, number 7, killed himself a couple years back.
Matilda gasped upon hearing the name.
Vang?
She asked. Dr. Song nodded.
Theo Vang. I couldn't save him.
I tried, but...
It's okay, Dr. Song said. You couldn't have known. I'm only thankful that there were so few subjects. We were making such great progress. I had hoped we could help the Null when we'd completed our primary goals, but... Then... Dr. Tyriel killed herself. She was our guiding light, you understand? The only way we were going to make thought reform a reality was with her research. But she felt like she was getting nowhere.
Matilda kneeled down beside Dr. Song, level with his face.
I'm going to assume you're telling us the truth.
That you and Ashanik's grandmother spent millions of dollars and did unthinkable things to children. Just to get at a truth that most people can read on someone's face for free. No tests required, no drugs. Just using the most human of skills, empathy. I'm going to assume you've already realized this, that you're truly trying to atone for it and accept your word. But comas, drugs, that's not going to do. Tell us how we fix Ashanik.
Dr. Song took a moment, pulling several folded sheets of paper from his pocket. He held them up for everyone to see. They were photocopies of a journal. The lined pages were filled with complicated diagrams that were surrounded by passages written in a strange symbolic language.
This clarity is all about mind control. Since time immemorial, there's been a concerted, though usually secretive attempt, to develop techniques to erase and reprogram people's minds. From poisons and electricity to mysticism and the occult. With the advent of modern medicine, however, new avenues have shown significant promise. Most pharmacological, but sometimes surgical. Dr. Tyriel focused on epigenetics, engrams, and mutation.
She believed that the core of a person's identity, so to speak, centered on the hippocampus. If you could ablate, essentially reprogram the mind. She recorded the process in a series of encrypted journals. She was paranoid, delusional. We were never able to decipher the encryption. The process she developed was incredibly complicated. Under their breath, some of the Clarity researchers took to calling her journals the Voynich Notes, named after the infamous, uncrackable medieval manuscript. The solution is the key to unlocking those notes. Because Ashanik has Dr. Tyrael's memories, she knows the solution. With the information, we can reprogram a linear particle accelerator and fix Ashanik's mind. Stop the voices. Make her normal. But Janet had her mother's memories too, right? Kojo asked. Why couldn't she have given you the solution? Why wait until now? Her real name was Janelle, Dr. Song said. And memories fade. Even though Ashaniks are vivid, it is because they are fresh. And some people deal with afflictions differently. Unlike her daughter, Janelle fought the memories that flooded her brain. She drowned them with drugs, alcohol, and rage. She likely didn't know what was hidden there. And if she did, she certainly wasn't willing to delve into it. We tried to convince her to try. We begged and pleaded, but more than anything, 51 wanted to forget. And when she had a daughter, her life was transformed, renewed. And we all hoped, Janelle most especially, that what she had forsaken, Ashanik might embrace. Matilda looked back at Kojo. He nodded and lowered his weapon. Okay, Matilda said. Where do we start? Dr. Song stood and motioned to the door. Down the hall is a washroom. There is a cabinet with hair dye and trimmers. I'd suggest that you lose the beard, detective. Matilda, you should cut and color your hair. Ashanik will need a makeover as well. Childers will help out. I'm afraid I'm not very good with this sort of thing. 56. 6:12 p.m., November 15, 2018, West Garfield Park, Chicago, Illinois. Reid stepped out of a rented Honda Civic and surveyed the house across the street, Kojo's house. It was evening, and most everyone in the neighborhood was home for supper, already full and gorging themselves on TV. The block was largely quiet, save for the incessant bark of a dropkick terrier stymied behind a vinyl fence. Over his lifetimes, Reid has had many dogs. He loved all of them. When he lived in the Caucasus Mountains as a trapper, he had a borzoi that would hunt alongside him. The dog had no name. It never needed one. They would spend days wandering mountain trails in search of game. Brown bear was a particularly challenging and thrilling quarry. Reid ignored the barking dog and walked up to the front door of Kojo's house. He was limping from the bullet wound in his side and the spot where one of Kojo's rounds had grazed him on the thigh. Reid was adept at sewing flesh. He'd stopped by a Walmart, grabbed supplies, and then did a little self-surgery in a bathroom stall, next to a man evacuating his bowels between pains and groans. 10 stitches, 6 butterfly bandages, no big deal. Reaching Kojo's front door, he rang the doorbell and waited, looking over the house carefully. It was not a place he'd ever chosen to live. It was too old. There would be too much upkeep. Reid was good with his hands. He prided himself on mechanical skills. But spending his weekend repairing siding and replacing roofing tiles would sap his energy. He had a hard enough time keeping his own body at bay. He didn't have a second to waste on crumbling pile. But he did find it odd that a detective lived in the house. It seemed a bit cultivated for a police officer. There was an art to the place, and briefly, he wondered if he'd been underestimating Kojo. The door finally opened, and Ophelia appeared behind the screen door. What can I do for you? She didn't open the door, didn't even unlock it.
This is Detective Omabo's residence, correct?
Ophelia crossed her arms. She was in no mood. After Kojo's brusque phone call and Brandon's difficult afternoon, the very last thing she wanted was to deal with some weirdo. Twice a week this seemed to happen. Someone rapped at the door and stood there expecting to talk with the police detective, as though he'd be willing to solve any problem in his off hours. In her hometown of Asinfoso, there were people who would show up at the priest's house at all hours of the day. They would show up and demand, yes, demand, special attention. A prayer for their sick cousin, a petition to the Lord Jesus that their daughter gets good grades in school, despite her attention deficits, or a plea to God to ensure that their grandmother finds her way into heaven. Here, it seemed, the police were like the priests. So long as they weren't in their cars patrolling, they were the ones everyone turned to when they needed guidance.
"He is not available at this time,"
Ophelia said, perfunctorily. She found the man's demeanor strange, but the look of him was even stranger. Her first thought was that he must be suffering from cancer. Ophelia had several good friends who'd undergone chemotherapy treatment. A few of them wore their bald heads as a badge of courage, a fit to the cancer attempting to destroy them. This man, however, was as bald as they were. It seemed even his eyebrows were missing as well. But he didn't appear ill. If she were forced to say, she would have concluded it was a fashion statement. If that was indeed the case, it was a poor choice. Ophelia considered the man hideous.
"Oh, I remember now," Raid said. "He's across town."
Ophelia moved to close the door, but she was too slow. Hesitant, even though she was unnerved, Raid sliced through the screen door with a box cutter that he seemed to pull from nowhere and, in one fluid motion, grabbed Ophelia by the throat. He squeezed until she couldn't breathe. Her head swam as carbon dioxide instantly began its deadly buildup in her blood.
"Who is at the door?"
Brandon's voice bounced from behind Ophelia.
"Oh, God. He needs to run and hide. Scramble as fast as he can up the stairs and lock himself in his bedroom."
Ophelia wanted to scream to him,
"Don't come any closer. Go to your room, right now."
But she couldn't barely get a sliver of air down her crushed windpipe. Ophelia knew she'd lose consciousness in a matter of seconds. Desperate to forestall the man from entering the house, she tried to grab his arms, to dig her long nails, just shellacked yesterday, into his flesh. But her vision was dimming, and the screen door was still in the way. Her nails raked the metal mesh, but she blacked out completely. The man pulled her closer, dragging her face through the screen door. The sharp edges traced a bloody grid across her chin and forehead.
"You will pass out," Raid said, "and I will take the boy."
Ophelia's body went slack. The sensation was like being dunked in freezing water. Her toes, then feet, went numb. Her fingers and hands followed. Finally, emptiness swept up through her burning chest and into her head. She was almost thankful when it extinguished the furnace of pain and grief raging inside her oxygen-starved brain. Then, a sweet, effortless darkness overwhelmed her. Brandon was frozen to a spot on the stairs. He couldn't take his eyes off the pale man stepping through the ripped screen door and into his house. The pale man closed and then locked the front door. He had a knife in his hand. The blade glimmered in the half-light, like one of those deep-sea fish that Brandon saw on a Discovery show once. Brandon had seen a horror movie once, too. His dad didn't know, but one time Ophelia left the TV on when she thought he was asleep. He was thirsty, so he crept downstairs to get a drink of water. And that's when he saw it. On the TV, there was a man with no hair and deep black eyes. He had a knife, and he chased two teenagers through a dusty old room. The pale man looked like the same man from the horror movie. He had a knife. Ophelia was laying there, bloody and dead.
"Hello," Raid said. "You and me are going to take a little drive."
57. 6:42 p.m., November 15, 2018. New Beginnings Rehabilitation Basement, Chicago, Illinois. Ashanik felt like she hadn't eaten in forever.
Come on in here.
After Childers had done the girl's hair up in cornrows, she directed Ashanik to the concrete room she'd arrived in. Dr. Song had set up a folding table in the middle of the room. Sitting there, waiting for the food Childers had promised to bring, Ashanik looked around the room and remembered something her mother had told her. She said that the other people who were on the run, the ones who could see things other people couldn't, were excellent at hiding. They could hide almost anywhere. For Ashanik, those words conjured up images of people hiding in the forest or on boats in the middle of the ocean, but now she knew the truth. They were hiding in the basements of drug rehab centers. They were in cramped, nasty basements with roaches and silverfish, and people hanging in sad hammocks. Ashanik's stomach rumbled. She wondered about what sort of food Childers could possibly get.
Maybe McDonald's? Maybe a submarine sandwich?
Ashanik hadn't had one of those in years. The last one she'd eaten had ham and tomato and a ton of mustard. She devoured every inch of it, even the pieces of bread that were soaked in mustard and had no meat or even tomato to squeeze between them. Childers walked in with a small plate of food and a bag of maxi pads. She put the maxi pads down on the table first and then positioned the tray right in front of Ashanik. Apparently, Childers didn't have to go far to get the food. It was from the cafeteria in the treatment center, 15 feet overhead. The night's dinner was turkey with stuffing, mashed potatoes and gravy, a side of green beans, and a thing of bright orange jello. Ashanik was hungry enough that she wasn't going to complain about not getting McDonald's. She'd never really been a fan of Thanksgiving food, though. At least there weren't cranberries in the stuffing.
Thank you,
Ashanik said.
Sorry,
Childers replied, reading Ashanik's less than excited expression.
It's pretty much that or some saltines and peanut butter.
No, this is great, really.
Childers turned to go, but Ashanik cleared her throat and asked,
Do you mind just sitting with me for a little bit?
Childers hadn't spent more than 15 minutes talking with anyone other than Dr. Song for nearly 3 months. Even though she wasn't exactly the most extroverted person, she found she craved some casual conversation now and then, even from the Null. Childers wasn't like them, but she wasn't like Dr. Song either. Neither fish nor fowl, as her religious and long-dead mother would have said. Childers tried to look that expression up once. Apparently it wasn't biblical at all, but some 16th-century monk claptrap. Regardless, it fit Childers to a T. That was another of her mom's expressions. Ashanik took a few bites and chewed them slowly. She swallowed and sipped some water before she asked,
You watch TV?
Sure,
Childers said.
You?
Yeah, it's kind of stupid, but I like cartoons.
That's not stupid.
I'm 11.
Cartoons aren't for babies. Some of them are pretty clever.
You don't watch them, though.
Childers didn't have a childhood that included cartoons. When she was little, still a boy, and called Caleb, a name she always hated because it sounded harsh, like a weapon. Mom forbade any and all film entertainment. No TV, no movies. Plays were okay, so long as they were religious. Childers' dad was only a photograph, and a blurry one at that. Her mother said he was a great man and nothing more. For a while, when she was in middle school, Childers wondered if maybe, just maybe, her father was an angel. How else to explain a girl being trapped in a boy's body? Surely there had been a divine mistake. Perhaps her father had been a rogue angel, one of the flukes from Genesis, the messiest part of the Bible. The first cartoon Childers saw was at a shelter. She was 15, and she'd run away after her mother found her wearing a dress in her room. All it took was a single glance. The rage in her mother's eyes was enough to convince her never, ever to look back. And she hadn't. Shelters, couches, excruciating acts. One underground, the Trans Express, led to another. Childers met Dr. Song at a shelter in Logan Square. Well, met was wrong. She had been threatened by another resident, a skinhead who had a thing for curb-stomping homos, and ran to hide in the basement. That was how she found the sleeping Nulls and Dr. Song. Turned out he needed help. After 20 years on the run, his body was finally showing the wear and tear. She offered, he accepted. Over the last 5 years, they'd moved in and out of 8 different facilities. Childers had never seen the agents of the HED, or the bald man Dr. Song seemed to fear the most. But she didn't doubt their existence either. She'd seen enough of the horror of the world to know that people were capable of the worst possible acts.
Those people in the other room?
Yes.
How long have they been sleeping?
2 of them for at least 3 years.
That's not good for them, right? To sleep that long?
They don't really have a choice.
But that's going to change, Ashanik said. I can fix them.
That's what Dr. Song tells me.
You don't believe it?
Childers took a moment.
Dr. Song told me all about the science of it. Even though I don't exactly get all the words, I get the core of it. And it makes sense.
I'm a living example of how wires get crossed and things don't exactly turn out the way they were supposed to.
Same time, it has me worried.
How often do you go to the doctor with a cold, and he gives you another cold to fix it?
The solution is different.
You remember it now?
Ashanik nodded. I think so, but...
But what?
There was a knock at the door. Matilda stuck her head in. She dyed her hair blonde.
Childers thought it looked good, though it was something of a sloppy job. Kojo stood behind her, clean-shaven. He looked different, more refined.
Sorry to interrupt, Matilda said. Do you guys mind if we come in?
Ashanik finished her meal with her plate on her lap as Dr. Song, Kojo, and Matilda joined her and Childers at the folding table. Dr. Song spread some file folders out before he passed out key cards and badges. None of them had Matilda's or Kojo's or Ashanik's face on them, but there were 2 for Childers and Dr. Song. He also had a duffel bag. Inside was a taser, a few rounds of 8mm ammunition, and several coils of rope.
I can get us into the facility. When the Linac went live a few months back, I made some,
recognizance missions over there.
That makes it sound like spycraft. But really, it was a matter of sneaking into HR and convincing them I was still an employee. The best thing about HED is that it's far too big for its britches now. You picture these conspiratorial groups as being highly sophisticated, lean black ops machines that can turn on a dime. They're not. They're just as clumsy and overburdened as the rest of the government. Unlike Health and Human Services, however, the HED has a team of hired hitmen.
What's your game plan? Kojo asked, as he thumbed through the things on the table.
We're all just going to follow you in? It's a hospital. We can get in just fine, but we'll need a vehicle to load up the null patients. Something like a van.
I can get that, Kojo said. Matilda and I will go.
On her way out, Matilda found Ashanik in the clinic with the sleeping Nulls. She was standing by Alice, staring down at the woman's slack face.
I remember 26, Ashanik said. My mother always worried about her. She was so slight. Such a pale and sickly-looking little girl. Who knew she'd be one of the few to make it this far? 26 was from a warm climate. None of the kids could remember where they came from. Electroshock and drugs took care of that. Well, until the machine awoke their memories, but some of their likes and dislikes, those were hardwired. Electroshock and drugs couldn't remove them. 26 had this thing about the yellow color. She loved it, and used to talk about wanting to live in the mountains so she could watch the aspen trees change color from green to yellow. I wonder if she ever did after they got out. Matilda kissed Ashanik's forehead. I'll be back soon.
Then we're going to get you well. 58. 7:38 p.m., November 15, 2018, Chicago, Illinois. Kojo and Matilda rode down Lakeshore Drive in a rented commuter van. The back was spacious enough to fit three wheelchairs comfortably. Outside, the clouds had cleared, and the moon was perfect and bright. Anxious to hear from Ophelia, Kojo phoned the house. It rang five times before he heard his own voice. "You've reached the Omaba residence. Please." Kojo tried Ophelia's cell. She rarely kept it with her, preferring to have it in her purse because she read somewhere on the internet that cell phone signals could give you brain cancer. It drove Kojo crazy, but he never doubted her commitment. She might be late here and there, and she didn't always answer the phone, but Brandon was so deeply happy when he was with her. The call went straight to Ophelia's message. Kojo hung up and slid his cell into his pocket. "Tell me about your son," Matilda asked. Kojo smiled, just thinking about him. "Brandon. His name's Brandon. He's 12, going on 35.
A handful, huh?"
"Yeah, but not something I can't handle." Matilda glanced at Kojo's left hand again. Not only was there no wedding ring, there was no evidence of him ever having worn one. 12 is a tricky age for a boy. Lots of changes going on. "Brandon lets me know. He's good about that." Kojo looked over at Matilda, seeing if she was getting him. She was. He continued, "If anything, I raised him to be vocal, to speak out, you know? He's proud and he ain't shy. Something has him freaked out, he's going to tell someone, either me or Ophelia."
"His mom?"
"No, his mom's dead. 5 years ago. Uterine cancer. No, Ophelia is his nurse. My son's got Down syndrome. It's not that he can't take care of himself. Just the other day, I found him in the kitchen, making his own version of tacos. He had the beans, the cheese, was using tortilla chips and gluing them together with the bean paste to make a shell. He can take care of himself, but he needs help, you know? He's got the confidence, just needs the guidance. And unfortunately, I can't be around as often as I would like. I've worked with a few cops. It's a tough life. Lots of stress." "Stress I've got under control. Don't take me wrong. I don't sleep well and I have some anger issues. Most of that I chalk up to the job. But, I have my outlets." "Okay." The way Matilda said it, Kojo knew she thought he was drinking or popping pills to see himself through his day. He didn't blame her. When someone was a shrink, he or she saw the world through that lens. Everyone was screwed up in one way or another. Kojo knew she was programmed to do it. Same way he read people on the street. Same way he scanned their eyes, their features, their hands. Maybe he carried a gun, and maybe she's got an advanced degree. But what they did was fundamentally the same. They read, and they reacted.
"It's not like that," Kojo clarified. "I do woodworking. Have a setup in my garage. I'm not going to say I'm anything great. I'm no Wendell Castle. I make furniture, mostly end tables and chairs. I don't sell them. Just give them to family and friends. You know, holiday gifts and such. Any weekend I'm off, that's where you'll find me, covered in sawdust." Matilda laughed. Kojo wondered if she pictured him sweaty and shirtless, working the tools. It was a funny image, not something he associated with himself, but he sort of wanted her to picture that. Hearing her laugh, seeing those dimples, Kojo couldn't help feel but a bit giddy. A lightness in his head, an effervescence. Before meeting Matilda, he hadn't felt that sensation in a very long time. "I love to see some of your stuff," Matilda said.
"Sure, I could send you some pics.
It'd be nice to see it in person. Just, I don't know. Sometimes it's hard to tell with furniture unless you're right there, able to touch it,
feel the wood? Matilda trailed off. Kojo realized he was staring at her. The moment of silence grew like a bubble around them, drowning out the traffic and the infinite thrum of the tires on the asphalt. Matilda broke off eye contact first, looked at her lap.
So, how exactly did you pick up woodworking?
Kojo cleared his throat, turning his attention back to the road.
My grandfather back in Ghana. He was a woodworker. Pretty good. Used all the traditional tools and stuff. And no, he didn't make spears.
Kojo shot Matilda a look. She recoiled.
No, I wouldn't have.
Kojo laughed.
Relax. Just a joke. People make so many assumptions about me because of my name. They hear my parents were Ghanaians. They think maybe I was raised in a thatch hut. Had goats as playmates. Went hunting with lions with long spears. You know, that kind of bullshit. My dad was a doctor. My mom was a teacher. They moved to the States 2 years before I was born. I'm as American as it gets. How about you? From Chicago?
Yeah. Native girl. My mom's had a hard time the last few years, but she was wonderful when I was growing up. Really caring, devoted to me with everything she had. No way I could ever repay her for everything she sacrificed to make sure I turned out halfway decent.
I'd say you're more than halfway decent.
Thanks.
Not much more,
Kojo jokingly clarified.
But a little. How about your dad?
He was never really part of the picture. He and my mom met while she was in grad school. She said he was handsome and collected books. Beyond that, he was pretty much an asshole.
Minnie, he found out she was pregnant. After 3 months of dating, he took off. And not like stopped calling her, but basically up and disappeared, moved to a new town, and left nothing behind.
Asshole.
Pretty much exactly right.
You ever try to look him up?
Matilda shrugged. When I was younger and trying to figure out who I was. You know, the whole early 20s soul-searching thing. But I never got anywhere. After a few months, I stopped trying. I realized I'd have nothing to say to him. But you're a good dad. I can tell.
Thank you. How?
I don't always feel like a very good dad. You're patient, but interested. Polite, but firm. Maybe it's this whole woodworking thing that's blinding me, but I feel like you've got what people call an old soul. There's a sophistication to you, a maturity, that most people rarely achieve. It's amazing how the slightest thing, a missed appointment, a bounced check, a single ugly glance can turn some people completely upside down. I've worked with patients whose lives have fallen apart, like completely. Because of the most trivial thing snowballing into an avalanche. But you seem really even-keeled. Like you know exactly who you are, and you don't need to prove it. Like I said, that's the makings, at least in my book, of a good dad and a good person. Thank you.
I try.
They rode on in silence for a moment, before Matilda said, You could have taken that gun from me any time, right? Just ripped it out of my hand?
Yeah.
So why didn't you?
Kojo sat back in his seat, cracked his knuckles.
I can see Brandon and Ashanik. She's got his same tenacity. And she believes in people, in the goodness of people, the same as him. I believe her. I do. All the memories she says she has. None of it makes sense when Dr. Song talks about it. But Ashanik knows, and I can tell.
Matilda reached into her purse and pulled out a folded post-it note and pen. She used the window to scribble something on the note. A few words in shorthand.
I say something that memorable? Kojo asked.
No, you just reminded me of something.
I saw your office. Wasn't prying. It was part of the crime scene, right? I noticed the notes taped up everywhere.
Hard not to, Matilda said, a bit embarrassed.
Talk to me about that. All those notes on the walls and doors. Is that research stuff? Solving the chemistry of memory? Or is it, I don't know, like you're putting your brain on the outside? Just to see it all more clearly? It sounds really stupid, but I think you get what I mean.
Doesn't sound stupid. It's hard to explain. You don't have to. Just was asking.
Matilda reached over and touched Kojo's shoulder. A shiver of electricity rippled through his muscles. The comforting power of human touch. The flood of oxytocin and endorphins. Even though he wasn't normally a touchy person, he found the warmth of that contact instantly soothing. It grounded his thoughts and solidified his feelings. Kojo slowed the van as they came to a light. He'd found Matilda attractive at the university, but that was reflexive. The sort of double take you do when you see a physique that checks those mental boxes. A muscle memory. Sitting in the car, just the two of them, in their bubble of silence, he found her beautiful. It was her mind, her words, her boldness, the way the fading light played in her eyes, and the condensation on the window that created a halo around her hair. Kojo was exhausted. He'd broken the law and probably lost his job, but he wanted nothing more than to kiss Matilda. He didn't.
Arsenic puts everything in perspective, doesn't she? He said.
She's changed my life.
The light flicked to green, and Kojo pressed the pedal down.
59. 8:51 p.m., November 15, 2018. New Beginnings Rehabilitation, Chicago, Illinois. Kojo pulled the van up to a loading bay, just off the kitchen of the rehab facility. Childers was there with the three comatose Nulls. They were wrapped in thick coats and propped up in wheelchairs.
They going to be okay for a while?
Kojo asked Childers as he got out of the van.
Yeah, they're just sleep is all. We drive safe though, okay?
Of course.
As the Nulls were moved to the van, Matilda headed inside. She found Arsenic pale and shaken, sitting in a wheelchair. She hurried over to the girl and kneeled at her side. Dr. Song was nowhere in sight.
Arsenic, are you okay?
The girl moaned.
My head hurts.
Shit, Matilda said, looking around the room for Metrochime. Did Dr. Song give you any medication while we were gone? Did you tell him you weren't well?
He knows, Arsenic said. Can't do anything about it now.
What do you mean? Dr. Song appeared in the doorway. Matilda stroked Ashanik's hair and then kissed her forehead before she walked over to Dr. Song.
She's getting worse. Can't you do anything for her?
Dr. Song pulled Matilda into the hallway.
The condition is progressing more rapidly than I'd expected, Dr. Song said.
Why?
She's different from the others. All the Null I've seen have been directly involved in the Clarity experiment. The past life memories flooding their heads are a direct result of exposure to the Linux. But Arsenic inherited what happened to her. For her, the mutation is inborn, like albinism or some regressive gene.
You're saying she can't be cured?
We don't know that. She's different. I believe that if the Null can be activated the way they were, then it stands to reason that Arsenic can be deactivated in a similar fashion. It's merely a matter of reapplying the suppressor system that was already in place, but only the Linac can do it.
Matilda stepped to the side and glanced in at Arsenic. The girl seemed to be getting paler, sicker by the moment. Matilda didn't want to take any risks.
She's not well enough to travel.
We don't have a choice, Dr. Song said. I can pump her full of Metrochime, but at this point, I'm not sure what good it will do. If we wait more than a few hours, I'm sure the most logical step is to ease her into a medically induced.
No way you're knocking her out.
Dr. Song shook his head.
Then she has to go now. The sooner, the better.
How certain are you the solution is going to fix everything?
Trust me, Matilda.
I can't.
Don't trust me then.
Dr. Song told her,
trust the science.
As she looked in at Arsenic, The girl managed a slight smile. It was enough.
Let's go, Matilda said.